Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. So there aren't many people in the world right now about whom you could find a wider variety of opinions than Edward Snowden. He was officially nominated last year, and I don't know how many of you know this, for a Nobel Peace Prize by two Norwegian politicians who had nominating privileges. He is, as you no doubt know, under indictment in this country for allegedly violating the Espionage Act. He was called a hero by John Cassidy in The New Yorker. He was called not a hero by Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker. He was called a traitor by Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, something he has not been charged with by the government. He was called a whistleblower by the New York Times editorial board. He was called not a whistleblower for many of his leaks by Fred Kaplan in Slate. I would love to give Ed and Laura a sense of who is here tonight. I think they may have a little bit of a sense just from the reception so far. But you'll know a little bit about who your neighbors are, too, from this. So who here lives in Brooklyn? And who here lives in Manhattan? Wow. Now we know where Manhattanites go for culture. Who here lives in New Jersey? Who here has seen Citizen Four? Wow. Laura, I don't think Ed is the only person they're cheering for. Who here has seen any other Laura Poitras films?
I told you so.
Who here found out about this event by hearing it mentioned on WNYC? And found out through BAM channels? Who here tends to think Apple should allow the government to look into the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone? Who does not think Apple should allow the government? Who here thinks the government actually can look at the phone without Apple's permission? Uh-huh. Who here considers Edward Snowden more hero than villain?
Thank you.
Other way around? Brave souls to applaud. It's hard to be a minority in any context. Who here follows Edward Snowden on Twitter, by the way? So who among you saw his tweet when that big blizzard hit the Northeast in January, the tweet that said, even D.C. will now be Snowden? Proving that we are a very free society because even very earnest civil liberties crusaders have a constitutional right to make bad puns. Hi, Ed.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation to speak.
So, Edward, we're here in the BAM Opera House in Brooklyn, about a 2,000-seat theater. Laura and I are on stage with a really big screen showing your face. For the sake of our audience, how much can you describe where you are right now?
The same way that I always am. I'm in my personal studio. Like, I don't have a team. So I have to do everything myself. I set up my own lighting. I set up my own cameras. I set up my own computer equipment to do audio-video processing, because this sort of dynamic we have today where increasingly we see more and more dissidents being driven into exile in the way that we did in previous sort of eras of increasing political tension or ideological tension in previous generations, we're denied the physical ability to move from country to country and speak to the various forums where matters of importance are being discussed. But thanks to the advent of technology, those sort of old bad tools of political repression are beginning to fail. We have individuals now, people like me, who can work in a vacuum and yet still be able to speak in New York. Even if that doesn't make the FBI very happy, the same context applies for dissidents who want to speak out in other countries, any country, you know, Russia, China, Iran, Brazil, France, Germany, Israel. And this is really explains and contextualizes why we see so many governments, including governments that we would consider to be liberal governments, Western governments, presiding over sort of open and free societies, that are concerned about their inability to restrain people's access to technology. They frame this in a false choice between security and privacy, but the reality is that we can have both. What it's really about, surveillance isn't about safety. Surveillance is about power. When you look at what the NSA's powers and prerogatives and programs are actually being used for and what their effective use is about, it's largely about this generalized category we would call foreign intelligence. This is where they want to do something like, for example, spy on Angela Merkel, the German chancellor's cell phone, or they want to know who she's sending emails to, even though she's a close ally. Now, that is a violation of law, but at the same time, we go, it doesn't really matter, because we could gain some sort of intelligence or informational advantage by stealing this information, and that serves as a nation. Now, people can agree over whether that's right or wrong, but we can at least understand that there's an argument to be made there, that there's a lot of value that's derived from that. On the other hand, we have these programs of mass surveillance that are monitoring everybody, everywhere, without regard to whether or not they've done anything wrong. This is what the government calls bulk collection, which is a euphemism for what everybody else refers to as mass surveillance. This is an indiscriminate method of dragnet collection of everyone's communication records in the United States. The first program, on the basis of the documents that I shared with journalists that were then published through the press, this is an important distinction because I didn't publish any documents myself, revealed that for more than 10 years, the government had been unlawfully, and this was upheld by the courts, they said no statute authorized this program. There was no law that permitted the government to do this. They had abused an authority by some other law that didn't actually permit this, a part of the Patriot Act called Section 215, to intercept the phone records every time you make a call of everyone in the country. These are American citizens and foreign nationals, everybody, everywhere, whether or not you've done anything wrong, and store these into records of all of your activities. They could find out what intelligence analysts, like the last position I worked in Hawaii, could use this kind of information, this metadata, as it's called. Metadata meaning activity records, what you did, when you did it, who you did it with, rather than the particular details of, for example, what you said on the phone. Now, the government says this is just, you know, they're billing records. You shouldn't really worry about it because it's just activities, right? But when you have a perfect record of all private lives in aggregate, this permits intelligence analysts to create what's called a pattern of life for every individual, regardless of whether or not they've done anything wrong. Now, this is when you got up. This is what you did when you got up. This is where you went to work and how, where your cell phone traveled, how it traveled, who it was associated with, whose cell phones traveled with your cell phones. It's largely the equivalent, metadata, is largely the equivalent of what a private eye would note down if they were following you around in your daily activities and writing everything you did down on a notepad. Now, they couldn't sit close enough next to you in every cafe that you go to when you speak with someone to hear everything you said, or you'd cotton on to what's happening. You'd get a little bit suspicion, go, who is this shady individual who follows me everywhere I go? But if they hang back just a little bit, they'll be able to watch you without you noticing, and they'll see where you traveled, who you met with, when you did it, for how long, and create a perfect record of all of your associations, all of the political organizations that you're involved with, all of your general interests on the basis of what stores you're visiting, where you work, where your friends are, who they are, and so on and so forth. And this is important because we have to remember freedom of association, freedom of speech, freedom from not just unreasonable search, but the unreasonable seizure of our records in the very first place, even if you don't look at them, is a violation of our Constitution. And this, critically, is what this conversation is about. Will we be a society that is free and open, or will we be a society where everything is monitored, regardless of whether or not we did anything wrong, because we could abuse our liberties? Not because we have, but because we could. And that, you know, there's an argument to be made for that. People might say, you know, this will result in a society where we don't worry as much about criminals because we can search any house at any time the minute someone leaves their house, and they'll never know about it, so don't worry about it. You shouldn't be afraid of this. If you're not doing anything wrong, what do you have to hide? What are you concerned about? But it's important to understand the founders of this nation were concerned about exactly this line of reasoning. They were fighting against a power that was the greatest in the history of the world at the time. They were fighting a king who was seeking the same powers of general warrantry, of indiscriminate search and seizure, that we're again seeing born today, not by some foreign government, but by our own. And this may be many things, and people can disagree about whether or not this could be done, but we have a process for that in this country. If the government wants to violate the Constitution, if the government feels the Constitution is improperly holding them back, they should amend it. They should not act in secret. They should not act without the knowledge or consent of the public about something that is of such vital and critical and ultimately fundamental public importance.
Thank you. Laura, let me follow up. I'll just note that my original question was, can you set the scene for where you are? I think since you have so many supporters in the audience tonight, people would like to know how you are. People would like to know what your life is like. People would like to know how you go shopping and whether you feel like you're being followed around by the Russian government all the time. What can you tell us about some of those things, just basically, or the room that you're in at the moment that you have to set yourself up in to do something like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's just an apartment like anybody else's. The idea here is, you know, why would people think that it's so different from ordinary life? My physical location is different, but that's not new for me. I worked for the CIA undercover overseas in Switzerland and other places. I worked for the NSA as a contractor in Japan and other places. And so having a foreign posting where I have to live in a country that I don't plan to stay in for the rest of my life to pursue work on behalf of my own country is really nothing new for me. I do have a normal life. I do all my own shopping. I ride the subway like everybody else. But, you know, people focus on the fact that I've been trapped in Russia by my government. And of course, this is really inconvenient. It is a burden. And it is a price that I've had to pay for the choices that I made regarding what we should be entitled to in regards to the public discourse. Should we be party to the decisions that are made by our government? Should we be partner to government, or should we merely be subject to it? But when people ask me, you know, how do you feel living in Russia? I think, you know, in my real day to day, I'm a child of the internet. All of my work happens online. I'm addressing people in every country around the world recently, and increasingly more and more back in my own country, which is of great solace to me. But more than anything else, I live on the internet. And this is really the profoundly important and different impact that we need to recognize is the trend of the future. This is something that empowers the individual. This is something that empowers society against all adversaries, not just foreign, but also domestic. If we have a government, if we have a state that can immediately and irresistibly sort of choke off speech, you have to think about how comfortable you would be with that, not just in the framework of our own government in the moment, but what that government might look like in the context of the next election and the one thereafter. Do you really want a single individual behind closed doors making decisions about the circumstances of your life? I think technology and the internet, and in an extraordinary and unpredictable way, my own circumstances, show there's a model that ensures that even if we're left without a state, we aren't left without a voice.
Laura, after Ed leaked his material to you in 2013, you said, or even before I think you actually went to Hong Kong and received it, that you didn't know if you would be able to come back to the United States after that. How close a call was that? And how comfortable or uncomfortable are you even being here at this point, given your role in all of this?
Sure. I mean, I think neither myself or Glenn or Ed actually thought that we'd end up doing a radio show here in Brooklyn. I mean, this
the
is
Opera
not,
House. You're in the Opera House.
Right. There were a lot of bad case scenarios that could have happened, and that didn't. After, you know, Glenn and I met with Ed, and we both went home. I was living in Berlin at the time, and Glenn is based in Rio. Both of us were told by our lawyers that it wasn't a good idea for us to come back to the United States. And that was the advice we got for the first year of the reporting, and I don't think that that was being paranoid. I mean, I think that there were a lot of reasons to be concerned. I think that the government was doing desperate things. I mean, we know that they downed a plane head of state and during this time, and then the detention.
For people who don't know, the plane of the president of Bolivia when they thought that Ed was on board trying to leave Russia, correct?
That's right, yeah. And Glenn's partner, David Miranda, was detained in London under the Terrorism Act, and which then initiated a lengthy investigation that's still, I believe, ongoing into the journalism that we're doing, that we have been doing and we continue to do, which the UK government defines as a terrorist conspiracy. So I had a lot of meetings even in Berlin about what could be potential risks of could the UK try to extradite me from Berlin during the sort of most tense months of immediately after Hong Kong. So this is, not, I don't think we're, any of us,
Do you feel vulnerable to prosecution either in the U.S. or UK or elsewhere, or do you feel that you are sufficiently protected as a journalist under the law in a way that Ed is not?
Okay, well, those are a few different questions in that. I don't think that we can take for granted protection of for journalism. I think we've seen really a targeting of journalists in recent years, many different cases, James Risen being one, they tried to compel him to discuss a source in a grand jury investigation. So I don't take it for granted. I think that right now it's safer for me personally, but that doesn't make it safer for other journalists who are doing this kind of work. And it certainly doesn't make it safer for whistleblowers, people like Ed and others who come forward to tell the public what we believe that we should know in a democracy. So I think it's, these are scary times. I think for my own personal situation is probably I feel more secure today than I did 2 years ago.
So let me bring up the Apple FBI case, because I'm sure a lot of people here are curious to get both of your takes on it. And Ed, you were quoted in the news just in the last day. There's a Vice News article that quotes you, as you probably know, on the FBI's position that it needs Apple to access the phone. You are quoted saying, respectfully, that's bullshit. Why do you think so?
So this is a fairly long and involved technical discussion, but the basic gist here is the FBI is asking for an easy button. They're saying, we don't want to do the work. We don't want to do the kind of investigation that the government has always borne the burden of throughout history. When the government needed to create sort of a national fingerprint database and so on and so forth, because they realized that fingerprints could be valuable evidence in the pursuit of criminal investigation, they fingerprinted people when they arrested them to compare them to databases. They tried to get fingerprints where else they could. They didn't compel every single person to give in a fingerprint, you know, down at the local county PD on that day, simply because that would be more convenient for them. In the same case of telephonic wiretaps, even back in the telegraph days, the government, in many cases, went to the places of business, they went to the places of investigation, the targets' residences. They did what was called sort of black bag operations. In the government euphemism parlance, these are called physical access groups. The CIA has one, the FBI has many, where they would do covert entries and they would leave behind bugs, or even the things that private investigators used to do back in the day, where they would put telephone wiretap clips, you know, alligator clips on the phone line so they could put a tap in place. Now, it's important here because while the government has, in some cases, sought legislation to compel assistance for from phone companies and so on and so forth to get them to hand over records that they already hold, the government has not required technology companies to actually reshape their operations, to change their products, to build in vulnerabilities and backdoors and weaknesses in the way that the FBI is seeking. There is no precedent for this. And revealingly, Apple put forth testimony in court, under penalty of perjury, that said no country in the world, and these are including sort of the bad countries that we're all afraid of, has asked for this kind of intrusive surveillance capability. And yet the FBI, of what we would consider to be sort of hopefully a country that's leading the standard for human rights, is now doing. So ultimately for me, this comes down to a question of necessity. In my background as a technologist, I know that laboratory techniques have existed since the 1990s for mounting physical attacks on the hardware of even secure devices. And this is where you would take the phone, physically disassemble it. You would copy the memory that exists on it through hardware means, and then you could put it on another phone that's more vulnerable. You can do what are called chip-off attacks, where you replace one chip with another one that you then write to the software you want to attack over. Or you simply repeat sort of the attacks where you would have the password on the phone that the FBI is saying they can't crack, and you would run 10 attempts. The phone would then wipe itself, but the part of the phone that's being wiped is something that you can just restore and then try for another 10 attempts, another 10 attempts, and you can automate this. Now, the hardware attacks that I was just showing reference, these are things that don't involve software at all. It's not necessary to go to that level. You don't need the manufacturer's assistance. You don't need code signing. Even sort of the secure hardware enclave type protections that the Apple iPhone in the newest versions has. And this, by the way, is not in controversy in the one that the FBI is going after. The FBI is going after an older, less secure phone that's even easier to hack. You can decap the chip, which is what you just saw, where you put a little bit of fuming nitric acid on the top of it to remove the protection, basically. Then you go at it with scanning electron microscopes or focused ion beam microscopy. These things might sound like Star Trek devices, but they're actually available in any American university of any sort of research level because these are common devices. The difference is, while hackers do this stuff in their garage, while academics, you know, smart graduate students, undergraduates are doing this kind of research routinely and publishing on this in journals every day of the week, in every city, in every university throughout our country and other countries around the world. The FBI has not invested in any kind of meaningful forensic capability to develop their own independent attack capability, their own investigative capability. That they've done.
And if I could interrupt and ask, why would that be? If they're so intent on developing all these mechanisms for surveilling everybody and everything like that, why wouldn't they develop the kind of attack capability for an iPhone that you were just describing?
Because it's inconvenient. The vast majority of the surveillance debate that they like to contextualize about as a security issue is really a convenience issue. The PRISM program, where the largest internet companies in the world were sort of co-opted and forced through a section called 702 of the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, which allows the government warrantless access to the communications of anybody in the world who's not an American citizen, and then warranted access to any U.S. person information through a very simple process, very easy point-and-click process. For companies like Google, Apple, Facebook, and so on and so forth. It's important to remember they already had access to this same information through traditional means of seeking a warrant before a court and then providing that warrant to these companies and getting the companies to respond. They wanted to simplify these processes. They wanted to automate these processes. They wanted to make them easier and less burdensome. Now, it's fair to say this is okay in some cases. You know, we want the FBI to have capabilities to investigate serious crimes. But on the other hand, we need to think about what is the impact on our rights relative to the gain that the FBI is claiming that they'll get. Now, they're saying that they're going dark without these capabilities. We know this is not the case because the FBI has put forth in their own reports things that say they've only been unable to access phones, even unencrypted phones, in, for example, I think it was 11 times in the calendar year of 2013, something like 11 to 14 times. Now, if this is something that only happens 14 times in a year, and it's normally low-level drug cases and things like that, does this justify reordering the whole of our society? Does this justify setting a precedent that American products and technology cannot be trusted?
So let me jump
whether
in
you're an American citizen
Laura
or foreign citizen.
To follow up, is this a case where it sets that kind of precedent? The government would say this is not metadata being collected on unsuspecting civilians. This is the actual San Bernardino shooter's actual phone, and he's dead to boot. So why is that a privacy concern for ordinary Americans that outweighs finding out if any terrorist networks he was in touch with are identified there or that kind of thing that they might be looking at, if you share Ed's opinion?
Well, I don't think it's just Ed's opinion. I mean, if you, I don't think it's, there's actually not a lot of debate about it. Everybody in the security community is supporting Apple's decision on this because of how dangerous this precedent is. And so I'm not personally a technologist, but I know a lot of people who are, and everybody shares this opinion that if you create means to get into systems, then anyone can get into those through those same means, and so you'll create a lack of security for everyone.
So would there be no way to find out how the San Bernardino or who the San Bernardino shooter was communicating with, or whatever other information he might have on his encrypted phone forever and ever, and that's okay?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of reporting on this that they had other phones that they physically destroyed, and these are the phones that I think that, that they had any incriminating information
what
on.
What if they didn't? Would that change the moral balance here, the ethical balance?
I think, again, if you look at everybody's lining up behind Apple, all the tech companies have taken the same position, that this is a really frightening precedent and it's very much overstepping the
The Justice Department says that Apple is doing this for commercial gain, looks good to their customers. You think that might be at all the reason?
No, I don't think so.
And I want to...
If I could actually follow up on that, because
sure.
You asked a lot of questions that do have a technical basis. One, and the most important part here is The FBI alleged they have the exclusive, or that Apple has the exclusive technical means for getting into this phone. That's simply false. There is no credible technologist who focuses on these issues, who specializes in this, who believes that is the case. There are literally commercial companies, groups like there's one named Chipworks, who literally their entire line of business is this kind of operation where you derive the secret from the hardware device. This would be the same kind of encryption key that's used for example, protecting pay for cable streams and like TV boxes, or providing copyright protection on video game consoles and things like that. There's a huge industry dedicated to this. So for the FBI to say, we can't get into this phone if Apple doesn't help us, that's simply not true. But even if that were true, which was sort of the following case you were alleging, does that justify changing the entirety of our society? I would argue no, and point to the fact that the entirety of the entire history of U.S. jurisprudence and the political history of our country is that we accept that the work of law enforcement will necessarily be difficult. We accept that our liberties and our open society, the freedoms that we enjoy as a nation, will insulate a few criminals from being held to the account of justice for the benefit of society more broadly. Now, this does not mean that we will not try our best. This does not mean that we will encourage the FBI, that we will fund the FBI. You know, Congress could pass a bill immediately tomorrow to give the FBI the funds to create this kind of capability in-house, the same way they did for DNA analysis, fingerprinting databases, and so on and so forth. But the idea that if the government considered it to be convenient to build a backdoor into all of our devices. And then they don't have to bother with this. They don't have to go to the expense. They can just tell the companies, you work for us now. That would make their lives easier. And yes, they would discover more crimes, not in the case of San Bernardino, particularly in the context of being in contact with other terrorist networks, because it's important to understand that data is not held on the phone itself. When you make a phone call, those records are held by the phone company in addition to being held on the phone. When you send an email, that travels over networks that you don't own, right? As soon as that leaves your wireless access point, as soon as that leaves the local Starbucks, that goes over AT&T lines or Verizon lines or other lines that do respond to the government. And of course, we have the NSA that has capabilities that monitor precisely this kind of thing. And they know, again, this is the metadata collection that they do today without a warrant, even for Americans, because they don't consider metadata to be legally privileged in the same way that content is. They know this phone was not in contact with terrorists. But even were that the case, if we allow the police to search anybody's house at any time without regard to any criminal suspicion, yeah, we would find a lot of crimes. We would find a lot of people with a joint or something else. They cheated on their taxes or something else. Evidence of that in their house. But we would then be a police state. And the final point here is that simply the virtue of the technology that even the president now, I think, unfortunately argued at South by Southwest today, he seems poorly informed by the technologists surrounding him, perhaps, or simply does not have technologists surrounding him and instead has policy officials, as Laura pointed out, because there is a global technical consensus that what is being asked for cannot be done safely. MIT did a study on this and found simply it cannot be done safely. If you build a backdoor into products, into technology, it can be used by anyone, particularly in the commercial context. If Apple builds a backdoor into their devices, as the government's asking for, the government says it's not a backdoor, but it is a backdoor. There's no nuance here. Either the encryption has a weakness that allows you to circumvent it, or it does not. If they do that, Apple will not only have to give access to this to the FBI, they'll have to give it to the Chinese FBI, to the Russian FBI, to every other country's FBI if they want access to their markets. So something that our government would argue is going to help us in thwarting terrorism in our own country is going to be used against dissidents, against journalists, against activists, and advocates in every other corner of the earth. And I do not believe, and many others do not believe, that that is a price worth buying a little bit more convenience for the FBI when we know there are alternative technical means they could use to get at the same information.
Ed, you heard us mention that. You heard us mention at the beginning that we were inviting questions via Twitter from people in the audience, and here's one that came in from someone who's here named Sean, who asks, who are security analysts? What are the recruiting streams specifically for security analysts? Military, math, grad programs, and why do people decide to take part?
So this is a really complex space. The government uses the term analyst very loosely. Analyst can actually mean hacker in the government parlance. Analyst can also mean you simply look at figures on spreadsheets all day. So it's extraordinarily broad. When we think about things like offensive security, like NSA's hacking unit called Tailored Access Operations, a lot of people get recruited, junior enlisted Air Force guys or junior enlisted Navy people. These are 18 to 20-year-old individuals who know a little bit about technology, but not all that much. They tested well. They have a basic grounding. Then the government sends them to a six-month course that's kind of paint-by-numbers, baby's first hack. There's this incredible mystique that the NSA has these hackers that are simply unparalleled and peerless. And that misunderstands sort of what's so powerful about their model. NSA is so successful not because they have sort of a stable of genius hackers. They do have some individuals who are extraordinarily talented. These are not the 18 to 20-year-olds. These are the 40 to 50-year-olds who develop processes that can then be repeated, that literally go checklist, step by step, through the process where you have no autonomy. If you hit a stage in this where anything doesn't follow the list, you immediately have to stop, and you have to hand that off to the expert. They use non-expert labor that has sort of a general familiarity to the maximum extent possible, and then they hand that off to more expert people. Now, who are these experts? These are contractors. Largely, these are not NSA employees because you can't hire the true experts at government wages. The people who are wearing sort of a government badge are typically people who simply through momentum have gotten comfortable in the position they're at. They have developed an expertise. This isn't to say they're dummies. These are good people who do good work. But, you know, they don't want to deal with jumping from contract to contract because it's a little bit less stable. But the people out there who are actually making much higher salaries don't actually have a specific loyalty to the NSA or to the government. They have a loyalty purely to a commercial group, to a Lockheed Martin, to a Booz Allen Hamilton. And this is actually quite dangerous because they could be reassigned to work on other projects. They could decide they're going to go start their own company to contract for a foreign government. They're no longer loyal first to the country, to the government, to the people, but simply to a private organization. And yet we are paying them to develop tools and expertise and programs that can be then used for anybody on the government dime, on the taxpayer dime.
So let me ask you something about your own biography that I read in a biographical article about you. I read that you enlisted in the Army Reserves when you were 21 years old in 1983. And you were training to be part of Special Forces until you broke both your legs in a training accident and were discharged. Assuming that's accurate, please correct me if it's not. If you were in Special Forces training, did you envision yourself as a soldier who would go on anti-terrorist missions, see yourself as a patriot, or why did you enlist and enlist in that in particular?
So there's sort of a misunderstanding due to the Hollywood nature of the representation of films of what special forces in the U.S. Army are. You think, you know, door kickers and trigger pullers. And while those units do exist, they're actually in different groups, typically some called Combat Applications Group or sort of the previously known as Delta Force or the Rangers and so on and so forth. Special Forces have a unique role where they're actually supposed to be inserted sort of behind enemy lines and work with the local resistance groups as in an advisory role to multiply their capability. You turn a force of 10 people into an effective force of 50 people by allowing them access to sort of our airstrike capability and so on and so forth to help build hospitals and schools for locals. At least that's what I believed was the case, because that's what's in the recruiting literature. Now, I didn't make it that far, so whether or not that's accurate, I can't say. These individuals are certainly better men than me in that context, and I respect them for the work they do. At the same time, I've become increasingly skeptical as I've gotten older of the value of our militarist adventures. That happened. I went into the Army in 2004 in the immediate wake of Iraq when everybody else was protesting because I believed the government's representation of why we went in, what we were doing, why we were there. They said we were there to free the oppressed, and to me, that sounded like a noble goal. Now, 10 years later, that seems like something that's very different, and I would ask, you know, Laura how she feels. Is that an accurate representation of the work of the military? And really, what the true purpose of the war
is. So let's do that. And I'll correct the misprint that I had here. I said 1983. Obviously, I meant 2003. And you corrected that to 2000.
I was born in 83.
Born in 83. So you enlisted on the day of your first breath. That's how badly you wanted to be a soldier.
I'm very American.
Laura, go ahead and answer his question.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I had a different response to the Iraq War, both the buildup to it and the invasion. That's actually what started this work I've been doing on post-9/11 Americas. To me, I mean, I felt that this was always going to be a failed endeavor. You don't occupy a country to bring democracy. I mean, these are two contradictory things. It would be like tying somebody up and kidnapping them and reading them Shakespeare. I mean, they don't go together. But I also felt that there was a really frightening precedent, global precedent, that this idea that we went to war preemptively and unilaterally. And so as the plans for the invasion were underway, that's when I realized I was going to make a film about the war. And I went there in 2004, at the sort of same time that Ed was signing up to join the military. I went to Baghdad to document what was happening there because I felt that we were getting a view of the situation from an enormous distance, that we didn't know what was happening there to Iraqi civilians or to the military, quite frankly. I mean, they were put in a horrible situation. I mean, they were occupying a country, they were imprisoning people, and they were being asked to, like, hold elections, and people were, you know, targeting them. So it was absolutely a tragic set of circumstances, And we're seeing the repercussions now with the rise of ISIS. I mean, we created a power vacuum in the region that is now we're seeing the unintended consequences of that power vacuum. And I think that what we saw in the lead up to the Iraq War was a real collapse of our media and asking the right questions. And we're seeing it again today in response to ISIS. Nobody is drawing. I mean, there is a direct line connection between the power vacuum that we created in the region and the ongoing violence that we're seeing.
And so you made this trilogy of films, Our Country, My Country, My Country, The Oath, which is more about Guantanamo and detention, and the third one is Citizen Four. Were you already working on that film as a film about surveillance when Ed showed up in your life in early 2013? Or was that film originally going to be about something else? Or was there no trilogy envisioned
right
until this came about?
So when I made the film about Iraq, I didn't imagine I'd still be working on these topics this many years later. I never imagined that Guantanamo would still be open this many years later. When I made the second film in the trilogy called The Oath, which dealt with Guantanamo, then I felt, okay, this is going to be a trilogy, and I felt that the third part of it, I wanted to bring it home, bring it back to the United States, and I explored a lot of different ideas. I mean, the type of filmmaking I do, it's not just driven by ideas, but it's driven by trying to film things that are happening in real time so that I can document them in real time, that both provide a record of a history, but then also understand, I think, these bigger issues through individual lives. And so I was looking for that, and I was actually deep into filming when Ed contacted me on the topic of surveillance. And for me, the topic of surveillance is kind of how the war on terror has been played out in the United States. It's been the front, it's been the government's front, and targeting particularly Muslim Americans, from September 12th, 2001.
So Ed, one more thing about the development of your current beliefs. Again, I read that by 2006 you were working for the CIA, and I've seen you quoted saying you were a trained spy, you referred to that today too, who worked undercover for the CIA and the NSA. Was there a period of time that you thought you were one of the good guys trying to stop the bad guys by working for the CIA or the NSA?
Well, that's why you sign up for the CIA. If you're someone who believes this, right? The thing to understand about how I got there, why I was there, the only way that you pass a polygraph is that there's a class of people, I was one of them, who grew up in a federal family. My father worked for the military for 30 years. My grandfather was an admiral. My mother worked for the federal courts. We were a federal family. I believed the government. I didn't think they had any reason to lie to us. I didn't believe the newspapers when they said, they're violating the law, the Constitution, because it just didn't make sense. The short-term political gain is so obviously not worth the long-term corrosive impact on the trust of the American people in their institutions of government and state that they would ever do this. And so I signed up for the Army. I signed up for the CIA, And when I say I'm a spy, I don't mean I'm running agents and recruiting people. I'm not James Bond. I simply meant in the practical sense of, look, this is a guy working overseas undercover, right? He's officially working in a job that's not his real job. He sends communications that are under a name that's not his name. This is not to say it's special or it's laudable or anything like that. It's simply to describe the facts of the work at the time. But as I spent more time in government, as I very rapidly sort of climbed the ladder in my career, far beyond what you would expect for someone who didn't have a college degree, I gained access to higher and higher levels of classification and documents that indicated our public representations of fact were very far apart from the actual facts of what we do, what our policies are. And this got worse as time went on. In 2012, the director of the NSA at the time, Keith Alexander, was asked to respond in Congress before the House of Representatives to an investigative journalism article that had cottoned on to the fact that the NSA was doing mass surveillance. And it looked like this.
Does the NSA routinely intercept American citizens' emails?
No.
Does the NSA intercept Americans' cell phone conversations?
No.
Google searches?
No.
Text messages?
No.
Amazon.com orders?
No.
Bank records?
No.
Now, obviously, that was not the most truthful testimony that he could have given at the time. This was not an isolated case. In fact, there's a federal official who is the most senior in the United States intelligence community, General James Clapper, who admitted he gave the least untruthful testimony he could to Congress at the time. Under testimony, this is sworn testimony. It is a felony to give a false statement in this circumstance here to Senator Ron Wyden. And just look at his hand and tell me that this is an official that does not know he is specifically committing a felony to mislead the American people, because Congress, this is the Intelligence Committee, they know what's actually going on. He's saying this to mislead us.
Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir.
It does not.
Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly.
Now, this is important for a number of reasons, one of which is simply it breaks the social contract between the people and their government. The government officials are beginning to excuse themselves from the same laws to which every other citizen is held to account. In our language, we have the terms public official and private citizens. We're supposed to know everything about them, and they're supposed to know very little about us, except in exceptional circumstances. And yet increasingly, we're seeing those public officials become more private. At the same time, they're creating mechanisms, machinery, and systems that make us more transparent to them. At the same time, they're no longer accountable to us. And the question is, you know, why did they lie? Why was this necessary? You know, what were they really afraid of? And when you look at the government's own documents, classified documents, things that can never be made public, it's a felony to reveal this kind of information. They say it wasn't to save lives. They say it wasn't because they thought terrorist attacks would occur if these things were revealed, but because they were afraid of a, quote, damaging public debate. If we knew about what was going on, we would complain about it. And they believed the scale of its activities could lead to legal challenges against mass surveillance programs. And we saw, as a result of these programs, they were right. We did complain, we did take it to court, and we did win, as we should. That's how the model is supposed to work. We have separated powers, and fundamentally, the press has a role to play in contesting the government for sort of a monopoly over, or contesting the government's monopoly control over official communications. So, this is not to say there should be no secrets, but the press should have some say in making the public interest determination of, is this really going to cost lives? Is this really going to lose us a war? Are we really going to have sort of U-boats and submarines in the harbor tomorrow and boots on the ground in Baltimore or Brooklyn or Manhattan tomorrow, if this is the case? Or is this a question of trying to protect political priorities at the expense of the public's say in the direction of our future society?
So, Laura, to follow up on that, At the Oscar ceremony, when Citizen 4 won Best Documentary last year, you said, when the decisions that rule us are taken in secret, we lose the power to control and govern ourselves, unquote. So part of the issue here is not just what the surveillance policies are, but that some of them have been made in secret, approved by a secret court. And I'm curious to get your take on how much the USA Freedom Act, incredibly passed by the Republican Congress in response to Ed's revelations, solves any of these problems.
Clearly not even close to enough. It doesn't even begin to touch the surface. I mean, what we've seen and the drift that we've seen in this post 9/11 era. I mean, we have to understand. I mean, this, you know, these, we've had two consecutive administrations that have made more decisions in secret than we can even, you know, that's incomprehensible. I mean, we have memos, legal memos that legalize torture, that justify torture. We have, you know, secret interpretations of laws that are happening. I mean, these are things we shouldn't be seeing in a democracy. And so I don't think I haven't seen nearly enough response by Congress to these, well, the revelations that have come forward from Snowden and others. So
I read, not I read, I saw Citizen 4, where it says there are 1.2 million people on various stages of government watch lists. And you yourself were detained in airports like 40 times between 2006 and 2012. 40 times?
Probably more than that. I think it's probably closer to 50 or 60. But, I mean, the watch list is an example of the dangers of secrecy in the government. When I started being detained, I started to try to find out why it was that this was happening. And not only would the government not provide any information about why it was happening, but they wouldn't even acknowledge the existence of a watch list, which the result of it is that for over 6 years, I was detained every time I returned to the United States and questioned and had my belongings searched and in some cases had my electronics confiscated. So, and there is no challenging, there's no due process within a watch listing system. And the only reason that we know a bit more about how watch listing works is another whistleblower who took a risk and has put his personal liberty on the line because he believes something was happening that should be something that's debated. So in my case, I mean, right now, actually, I've learned more because I'm filing a lawsuit with the help of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, are filing a lawsuit to obtain my records. And we've so far, we started receiving documents, heavily redacted documents, so far received about 1,000 documents from various agencies, from the FBI and from TSA and other agencies, and we're still, it's an ongoing legal process, but it's actually shocking the extent to which there was an investigation that was, you know, a terrorism investigation, there was a grand jury that was held, my records were subpoenaed. I don't know what records were subpoenaed because that's redacted from the documents, but I do know that there was a grand jury. I know there's reference to the CIA in my files. So it's a multi-year terrorism investigation into my work as a journalist.
And to the power of journalism, I gather you credit your partner in receiving Ed's leaks, Glenn Greenwald, that he wrote an article in 2012, after which they stopped detaining you at airports?
Right. What happened was I was traveling back from, I was filming. I had just done a film, a shoot with Julian Assange in the UK, and I was returning back to Newark Airport, and I was stopped, which had happened. It became normal. But in that particular incident, I was threatened with. I took out my pen to take notes of what was happening at the interrogation, and I was threatened with being handcuffed for taking notes, and repeatedly, not just by this agent, but by several agents, saying that to put the pen down because they said that my pen would be is a weapon that could be used against them. And these are border agents who are carrying guns, and they thought that I would attack them with my pen. And I got home from, after being there for a couple hours, being at the airport, and finally got home, and I sent Glenn an email, and I said, this has gone on too much, too long, and do you want to write about this? And he did a big piece on what had been going on at the border. And as a result, I don't know, I was taken off the watch list, but they did stop detaining me at the border after Glenn's piece. I actually don't think they took me off. I think that I was probably moved to another list that they call a silent hit list.
A what?
A silent hit list. There's a no-fly, you don't get on a plane. There's selectee, which I know was on a selectee list for 6 years, and then there's something called silent hit, which means they're tracking your movement. They know where you go, but you don't get stopped and harassed at the border.
Here's another tweeted question from somebody in the audience. All right, Ed, here we go. Ellen here wants to know, who will Snowden cast his absentee ballot for in 2016?
So there are a number of reasons that I won't answer this question directly, the foremost of which is,
come on.
As a privacy advocate, right? As a privacy advocate, we've reached a stage in society where we've forgotten that there was a period at which the idea of who you were voting for was considered a very private thing, something that should be protected, something that should be personal, the sanctity of the voting booth, as it was called. And when you look at the context of the modern political climate, when you look at the rising authoritarianism, not on the part of one party, but on the part of both, the idea that the government is indiscriminately collecting records of all of our activities everywhere, should we be putting ourselves out there on the line in a way that would make us vulnerable, not simply to criticism or debate, because that's good. That's actually, we want that. We want to have a robust conversation about our beliefs and our values, who we support, and so on and so forth. But to actually take that a step farther and publicly identify as I support this, I do this, that, and the other, it's important as an organizing principle that we have access to this. But I think it's helpful to serve as a counterpoint and say, you know, let's have some people who don't do this, simply to say that there are other alternatives, so people don't feel pressured to feel that they must give an answer, to feel like there's some requirement when a journalist says, oh, come on, about whether you'll answer this question.
Fair response.
Go ahead. I will say quite simply, if you looked a few years ago at the idea that we would have another Bush against another Clinton. That would have seemed like satire. Then Bush dropped out of the race and was replaced with Donald Trump, of all people. And the question is that an improvement? And I'll leave that to the listener to decide.
So should I assume that you wouldn't answer a question about whether you see Clinton and Sanders as being very much the same or meaningfully different on the issue of surveillance and on your fate?
No, I think it's fair, you know, again, to there's a difference between saying, I won't discuss politics, I won't talk about policies, and saying, I'm not going to say specifically who I'll vote for in the booth. When we think about Clinton and Sanders, the real difference here is, without taking a value position on whether this is a good candidate or this is a bad candidate, simply looking at their policies. Hillary Clinton has aggressively advocated for war in every circumstance where it was available as an option. She was in favor of the war. She was in favor of Iraq. She was in favor of Libya. And as we know, both of them have ended in disaster. And she doesn't seem particularly regretful in the case of Libya, which should be a concern, as she previously was not regretful about Iraq until it was eventually too late to make a difference. Now, I'm not an expert on either the policy positions of either candidates, but I would say when we have a candidate who seems less inclined to the kind of militarist adventurism that has caused the majority of the problems that we're dealing with now, again, understanding that this kind of interventionism was the original justification for Al-Qaeda's attacks against the United States, at least in their terms. We don't know whether that's reliable or not. There's a question here of, are they solving problems or are they creating more? One last thing. This is not related specifically to the presidents, but it is related to the blowback of our policies and things of that nature, is there is an argument in favor of mass surveillance that says, well, it would have stopped 9/11. It's important for us to educate each other, for us to understand the actual facts of the case if we go back and look at the history and find out that that's not the case. Mass surveillance wouldn't have stopped 9/11 because we already had the 9/11 Commission, you know, which is put forth by Congress, of all people, not exactly known as a vanguard of civil liberties here or careful, deliberate consideration on sort of matters of nuance. They found that the U.S. intelligence community already had all of the information it needed to detect the attackers and thwart the plots. The problem was that they did not understand what they had. The problem was not that we were collecting too little. The problem was that we had collected too much. And this is precisely the dynamic that bulk collection, that mass surveillance makes worse. So presidential candidates who seem more skeptical of this sort of indiscriminate collect-it-all surveillance, of indiscriminate, unconsidered violations of human rights, of carpet-bombing people, of torturing people, of military adventurism. Skepticism should be an attractive quality here because we have a specific example in our country that when you simply stop caring about the details and say simply, yeah, just collect anything you can, do whatever you want, it can end up costing us lives rather than saving them.
Uh-oh. And he's such a technical wizard. So while we're getting Ed's frozen face unfrozen...
This is exactly what I was afraid of.
Let me follow... Well, we have you here. Who needs him? Would you be afraid on his behalf if Trump is elected... Trump, who has said admiring things about Vladimir Putin, at least the strength with which he leads his country, that they might make a deal to extradite Edward Snowden?
Yeah.
More than under other scenarios, that is under other people being elected president.
I mean, I think actually a lot of us should be afraid of Donald Trump. So, and I would just like to say for the people in the room that Berlin is a great city. There might be a lot of people coming that direction, so I've got friends there, and I might be heading back.
Ed was just talking about before 9/11, and before Edward Snowden, there was William Binney, an NSA whistleblower who you made a short film about for the New York Times. And his story is so interesting, partly because he was concerned about unconstitutional overreach, like you've been talking about tonight, and at the same time concerned that the NSA failed to see the 9/11 plot in advance, which maybe what Ed was just referencing. How could it have been both with respect to 9/11?
So William Binney, do people know, he was a former technical director of the NSA, was a deeply knowledgeable crypto mathematician who did a lot of graph theory. He believed that they had the information and that they had the ability to connect the dots before 9/11. But, I mean, it's actually, you didn't need to be a genius to detect this. I mean, there were people who had trained in Afghanistan that the CIA knew had trained in Afghanistan with al-Qaeda, who had visas to the United States, and the CIA simply didn't tell the FBI. I mean, you actually did not need to have mass surveillance to detect that. You needed to have communication, and you need to have good analysts to warn. And so in that situation, I think that there's been a tremendous amount of reporting on how much, in a sense, how unsophisticated the 9/11 attack. They traveled in their names. They had trained. The CIA knew who several of them are. And so that's one question. And then in terms of William Binney and him coming forward after, there were a number of people. There was a group called the NSA-4 that started raising concerns internally immediately after 9/11. And they believed that if they brought those concerns within the channels of the agency, that they would be addressed. And that didn't happen. In fact, what happened is that the government targeted them very aggressively, particularly Thomas Drake, who was they charged him and wanted to also under the Espionage Act. And then in the end, there was a deal, and he was found guilty of a misdemeanor after they for years put him under investigation. And there are many cases like that. There's another case, Stephen Kim, who's a former State Department official, who somebody from the State Department asked him to speak to a journalist about what was happening in North Korea, and then the government went after him, and he ended up going to prison. And so there's the landscape of the targeting of whistleblowers is really frightening. And it creates context and to understand why Ed made the choices he did.
Ed, just one sidebar on the presidential race. I'm curious what you think from a cybersecurity expert's perspective of the Hillary Clinton email controversy. How much more vulnerable, if at all, do you think she made sensitive government information by taking off, you know, a so-called secure government server, her email, and housing it on clintonemail.com?
So this is obviously a charged issue, but simply speaking in the technical capacity, the problem here is you have the entire government's administrative resources that are invested in the security of a single email server, state.gov, where you've got hundreds of employees who can focus on protecting the server, who can detect breaches and remediate them when they occur, and it ensures that any communications within that server, right, if person A at state.gov within the State Department emails person B at state.gov about sensitive information, it never actually transits the internet. It never actually leaves the server. It just happens locally right there. If you avoid that and you take your emails and you create your own server or whatever it might be, and you've only got a single employee, a single individual who it's not their full-time job. Their full-time job is to work for the State Department, who just is kind of a part-time deal under the table, does a little bit of work for you maintaining the server on the side. It creates two primary vulnerabilities. One is the server itself can be penetrated and can be attacked. These attacks, if they're done by sophisticated adversaries, will leave no log traces. You can't simply look at the history and go, oh, it was attacked, or oh, it wasn't attacked, because smart adversaries, for example, the NSA and our counterparts at the top tier adversaries, France, Israel, China, Russia, these groups won't leave traces. They won't leave anything in the log. You won't know that it was ever hacked. But now they'll have complete access to all of the communications of the Secretary of State. Now, this is a priority one target. We hacked Angela Merkel's emails and phone calls and everything like that. It was revealed by a German newspaper, I believe. And this was done for many other heads of state, all of their foreign ministers, who's the equivalent of state, Secretary of State. But there's another vulnerability which is actually more important, which doesn't rely on hacking at all. And this is the in-transit communications. Because you've moved the Secretary of State's emails out of the Secretary or the State Department's systems, now it has to travel across the internet to get from point A to point B. And all of those communications happen without encryption. That means not only can you hack the server to steal the emails, any point in the middle of all of the many, many different routers and internet crossing points and internet service providers in that transit point can see what those emails are saying. The sort of attack surface, as it's called in our language, is extraordinarily broadened in a way that's, shall we say, quite risky. If I could pivot from this simply to follow up on the previous point about 9/11 that I was cut off from making, I guess the NSA didn't like that one very much. is what Laura was saying. The 9/11 attacks happened not because of the absence of mass surveillance, not because we weren't collecting enough information. As she indicated, the congressional investigation, the 9/11 Commission, found that we had all of the information we needed to thwart the plots. The problem was that we did not understand the information that we had because we had simply collected too much across too many agencies that weren't coordinating properly. This is critical in the context of bulk collection of the mass surveillance debate as it is. If you have presidential candidates who are not skeptical about the dangers of mass surveillance in the modern day, this should be alarming. Because we had a particular example in fairly recent national memory of the United States where more than 3,000 Americans died because we were collecting too much rather than collecting just enough.
Ed, you said you would come home to face... excuse me, you said you would come home to face charges if you could get a fair trial. The Constitution promises a fair trial with a jury of your peers, a right to a lawyer, etc. What aspect of a fair trial is in question?
The fundamental basis of what makes a trial fair is that both sides can present their arguments to an impartial jury, and the jury decides the merit of those arguments. In the context of national security investigations, this is something that's under threat. And we saw this in the case of Thomas Drake and Daniel Ellsberg back in the 1970s, who revealed the Pentagon Papers that were basically about how the government had knowingly lied to the public repeatedly over the span of about a decade to keep us in a war that they knew from near the beginning they could not win. Simply because they didn't want to take the political hit on it. And because of that, American lives were lost. But when they got to court, the government said, you can't say the word whistleblower. You can't argue that the actions that you took were in the public interest. The jury must not be permitted to hear that at all. And this, of course, is the fundamental basis of an unfair trial. That's a kangaroo court. If you can't present a defense, it's not a trial at all. It's simply a process. It's an extensive extension of the booking process. And it may be many things, but the one thing that it is not is fair. Now, I've asked the government to guarantee that a public interest argument would be available, that they would provide that, as is natural in every other legal system around the world, and traditionally is available in the American system as well. And they responded with a letter promising that I would not be tortured. It actually has the Attorney General's signature on it.
That much is fair. Well, on this question of whether you should be considered merely a whistleblower, Fred Kaplan, the author and Slate military affairs columnist, was skeptical of that when he wrote in 2014 an article that questioned it. He starts that article by saying Daniel Ellsberg is a hero of his and affirming what you were showing us on video before, that NSA Director James Clapper was lying to Congress and in Kaplan's opinion should be fired for saying there was no mass data collection program, et cetera, et cetera. So he's hardly Dick Cheney. But then he writes, it is true that Snowden's revelations about the NSA's surveillance of American citizens, far vaster than any outsider had suspected, in some cases vaster than the agency's overseers on the secret FISA court had permitted, have triggered a valuable debate, leading possibly to much-needed reforms. If that were all that Snowden had done, if his stolen trove of beyond top-secret documents had dealt only with the NSA's domestic surveillance, then some form of leniency might be worth discussing. But Snowden did much more than that. The documents that he gave the Washington Post's Barton Gellman and the Guardian's Glenn Greenwald have so far furnished stories about the NSA's interception of email traffic, mobile phone calls, and radio transmissions of Taliban fighters in Pakistan's Northwest Territory about something to gauge the loyalties of CIA recruits in Pakistan, about NSA email intercepts to assist intelligence assessments of what's going on inside Iran, about NSA surveillance of cell phones called worldwide, cell phone calls worldwide, an effort that, in the Post's words, allows it to look for unknown associates of known intelligence targets by tracking people whose movements intersect. One more paragraph. In his first interview with the South China Morning Post, Snowden revealed that the NSA routinely hacks into hundreds of computers in China and Hong Kong. These operations, writes Kaplan, have nothing to do with domestic surveillance or even spying on allies. They are not illegal, improper, or in the context of 21st century international politics, immoral. Exposing such operations has nothing to do with whistleblowing. So, how would you respond to that, specifically, any way you'd like, well, but actually, addressing his suggestion that you could have stuck to just revealing things about domestic surveillance?
I'm going to step in here. I mean, you have to say that you have to realize that everything that has been reported by journalists. So you have to talk to the individual journalists and what the public interests were on these particular stories and how they reached those conclusions. I actually didn't work on the list of stories that you read, but that is what Ed chose to work with journalists and to make those determinations of what was in the public interest. And we've been doing that. And I also think it's important to emphasize that other people on this planet have a right to privacy. And not just American citizens. And I believe that is absolutely public interest to report that.
Including people who, as I think that passage suggests, might be actively engaged in military or terrorist or whatever you want to call it, planning against the United States?
I mean, you'd have to talk to the journalists and the editors who reported those stories. I actually didn't work on those particular stories, and I don't know that I would make the same determination about what the public interest is, but that's how journalism works. I mean, you make a decision of what you believe to be public interest, and you work not just alone, but with a group of people, and that was... those were determinations that they were
but Ed,
of news value.
You chose to provide that information to journalists. So what was the public interest as you see it?
Right. So I'm glad you asked this question first off because it is important. One of the most important things is that Fred Kaplan doesn't do very good research, unfortunately, because he does have a lot of reach with his articles. He did not contact Daniel Ellsberg, who he cited in the lead of his article, who said that what I did was, in fact, precisely right. And that includes not trusting the FBI and the DOJ to guarantee a fair trial. He has met with me since and said, actually, even if the U.S. government did promise to provide me a fair trial, that I shouldn't trust it, that I shouldn't believe it. Now, I'm not sure that I could personally justify that. If that were on the table, then I would accept that anyway, despite the risk, simply to prove a point. If they're not going to provide a fair trial, despite their guarantee, that's something that the public should know. And, you know, it's Personally, I believe that that's something that we need to know. But let's presume that Kaplan's facts are correct, which they're not, but let's say they are. A lot of the things that he's talking about, for example, monitoring of individuals in Pakistan, have extraordinary public interest implications. One of the individuals who was flagged as an Al-Qaeda fighter was the chief of the bureau, of the news bureau for a major journalism outlet out there, who doesn't have any association with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. When we talk about sort of the Northwest Frontier province and like sort of operations of what's going on with this, that, or the other, that is the take of critics who don't actually understand what was discussed in the article and the fact that these were operations that had aged off. There's a article that was published by the New York Times, I believe, as this is another aside that's actually quite important for the context here, which is that the role of the free press in a free society is to decide what the public should know, to decide where we should be educated about topics of public importance, even if there are two sides, even if they think that this is dangerous or even if they think this is good, that there is such overriding importance that we must know. Now, this does not mean that there is no risk in publishing any story. This is not to say that some program could come to harm or some official's reputation could be damaged. But it's important to understand what these critics are doing when they're arguing against public knowledge of matters of public importance. They're trying to shift the conversation to talk about the theoretical risks of journalism rather than the concrete harms of these programs, which are so clearly demonstrated in the articles that the press decided to publish in the first place. Now, the New York Times has aggressively published a number of stories related to wartime activities that I may have made different decisions about personally. Now, it's important to understand here that I never provided any archive material to the New York Times myself. I provided information to the Washington Post, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel, I believe through Laura Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, and Barton Gellman. These outlets then partnered with other news agencies who made those judgments. Now, there's a question here, and a fair one, as you said, about, well, you gave them this information in the first place, right? So surely that means you believe that everything that you shared should have been published. It's all in the public interest to know every detail, right? It should be unredacted. It should be out there. Why didn't you just publish yourself? But that's not the case. Journalists need to understand the full scope of activities. That means not just illegitimate activities, but also legitimate activities, so that they're simply not reliant on the government's claims of where the lines are drawn about these programs, when they say, this saved lives, these activities are useful, and this is, you know, something that we're doing for this reason, that reason, or another reason. Even if they're not published, even if they're never intended to be published, these are materials that are necessary to the work of journalists. Because if journalists cannot independently evaluate a claim, free from the bias both of their source, myself, and the people that they're investigating, in this case, the unlawful activities of the National Security Agency and other surveillance agencies, you don't have a free press. You've got stenographers who are writing press releases for one side or the other. They're either representing a source's views, or they're representing a government's views or anonymous officials' views, and there's no in-between here. The other cases that you're saying are simply being misrepresented. When they're talking about things like hacking of computers in China, yes, of course, information about that kind of material is being revealed because it's about a global hacking campaign that affects every nation. And the specific context of that specific story is there are no military facilities mentioned. There are no terrorist targets mentioned. There are no government officials that were being monitored here where the Chinese go, oh, they caught us, let's change our operations so we can't be seen. This was about the hacking of critical infrastructure, hospitals, universities, power dams, things that if they were done to us would be considered an outrageous breach. And as Laura said, yes, it's important that we elevate and primarily focus on the rights of American citizens. But it's also important that we don't forget that 95% of the world's population lives beyond our own borders, and they do have rights too. And even though we may focus first on the rights of our own country, that does not mean that we should completely disregard the rights of everyone else.
Ari. Just one follow-up on that. In answering that question largely in terms of the independence of journalists, are you saying that you provided journalists with thousands of documents that you did not personally determine that, in your opinion, were in the public interest to be made public, and left it to their judgment as to whether they were or not?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not speaking to number of documents. I'm not speaking to, you know, particular how the assessment was done on this document's importance. What I'm saying is that journalists were provided information that was necessary to the work of journalists in my independent determination. I witnessed evidence of criminality. Right? I witnessed massive violations of the Constitution of the United States of America, but many laws affecting many people around the world. Now, the question is an individual acting on their own bias best placed to decide where the public interest is in evaluating these materials? Now, I did not personally believe that. That's not to say that's the only answer. There are alternative answers or alternative models out there, for example, WikiLeaks, that believe that the public should have the right to immediately access the source material, the raw source material, and make their own determination. And in many cases, this is in fact quite persuasive. When we look at the case of Chelsea Manning, for example, who is maligned by critics like the author of this particular piece, by saying they were indiscriminate, they released hundreds of thousands of documents. I think it was regarded as 750,000 documents that were revealed, that were discussed at trial, and that this was reckless and dangerous. And on its face, that seems persuasive. It seems that if this analyst didn't read everything right, there's probably a lot of danger there. These are secret documents, and the standard for classifying documents in the United States is that confidential documents, the lowest level of classification, will cause serious harm to the national security of the United States. Secret documents will cause grave harm, grave as in, you know, gravity, the grave of the earth, the ground that you will fall in when you die. And then top secret, exceptionally grave. And yet here we have a real world example where more than 750,000 documents that were classified at this secret level were revealed. And at the trial, the government did not argue that a single person died as a result. They could point to no single individual. They couldn't give a single name of anyone who came to harm as a result, which raises the question of, is it actually a question that there is information of such extraordinary sensitivity, the public simply must not know, journalists simply must not know because it's too dangerous? Or is this actually evidence of an over-classification problem where too much is secret that never should have been classified in the first place? Now, I tend to fall on the more conservative part of that because I'm a product of the bureaucracy. Again, I come from a federal family, and I'm over-conservative as a result when it comes to risk-taking, how these decisions are made. So I independently evaluated all of those documents. I assessed them for their public importance, for journalists to be able to review them and write stories on their basis. That doesn't mean every document should be published. That doesn't mean every document should be published in full. At the same time, I recognize that on the bell curve, this necessarily places me as an outlier. Whistleblowers are the fail-safe of last resort, right? When the other branches of government fail, when the other steps of the process fail, when the internal routes fail, as they did in my case, I tried to speak to my colleagues and my supervisors about this. I looked at the laws, and contractors had no whistleblower protections under the law that were meaningful. Even if I had brought this to Congress, I would have lost my job or gone to jail. But despite that, despite that everything seemed to indicate that, yes, the public should know this, I decided that I would impose additional layers of restraint to be more conservative. I asked the journalists to make their own independent assessments of what should be published and to discount my bias there on the basis of the documents. Then beyond that, Once the journalists had written those stories, even about stuff that, you know, seems to be dangerous, like, you know, let's talk about Northwest Frontier Province or whatever. It seems like it could be concerning wartime operations that might cause harm. In every case of publication, I required the journalists, as a condition of receiving the material, to go to the public in advance of publication and share with them the theme of their story, the basis of the documents that they were going to be published on, to make sure that the government could make the case that maybe the journalists didn't understand the danger of these documents. Maybe they were operating in a vacuum. Maybe they were missing some critical piece of context. And as a result, they would be publishing something that would put some life at risk, some program at risk, or our national security at risk. In every case, they have done that. In every case, the government has made its argument, and the journalists have either deferred to that, they have shaped, you know, some small detail out, but I've been told that's happened in almost no cases because the government has recognized that they have no meaningful defense. They have recognized that even in these programs and policies that a particular columnist might take issue with and say, you know, I don't like the politics of this because I think we should be sort of a neoliberal interventionist state. We should be able to operate in any country. We should go beyond borders and seize individuals without regards to the legal process. We should operate drone strikes in terrorists, we should operate drone strikes on territories. We should operate drone strikes on territories that are outside of any war zone simply because we think it's right. And there is an argument to be made there. I'm not saying these individuals are totally wrong. I'm saying it's a good thing, by God, that they alone are not the ones who decide that we, the public, should and should not know. We have a large, open, and adversarial free press specifically to make those determinations on our behalf, and I am glad that they did so, and I am comfortable with the decision that they've made.
So as we are about to run out of time, I'm sure everybody wants to know what you think the future holds for you. If you say a whistleblower defense, public interest defense, the ability to use one would be the condition on which you would come back to the United States and stand trial, and the government seems to have no intention of allowing that, then it sounds like you're stuck. How do you get off that square? And if you think you can't get off that square, what does the future hold for Edward Snowden as you see it?
Well, first, and I think most importantly, the key here is it's not that important. I simply serve as the mechanism of disclosure. What happens to me personally in the context of history, in the context of our country, is not especially important. And I'm at peace with it. As Laura said, when we were embarking on this endeavor in the early days, I personally expected very bad outcomes because they were the likeliest. I never chose to be in Russia, and I would prefer to return to my own country. I will continue to seek to restore my right to travel, to come to my country, and to return directly to engage in the political process there. But if that is denied to me, I will continue to work with much the same efficiency. I'm the director at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Today, where I work directly on issues of journalism, how do we protect them, not just against the NSA, not just against our own government, who in the global context are not the greatest threats, but against groups like Russia, against state security agencies in China, in the Central African regions, and things like that. And I'm quite comfortable to continue with this for the rest of my life. But more than anything, I'm encouraged by simply looking at what the results have been. In 2013, individuals like this critical columnist and many others like him, you know, he's not isolated, he's not alone, could credibly make these arguments of harm because we didn't know what would happen. In 2013, national security officials said, you know, there's going to be blood on this guy's hands, people are going to die. We're going to be attacked as a result. There's going to be invasions. We're going to miss everything. You know, Mexico is going to invade Texas. Who knows? For them, the sky was falling. This was the end of the world.
Trump says that's already happening, by the way, but that's another show.
Wow. But now, in 2016, it's not so easy to make those arguments. Now, this was the same in the case of Daniel Ellsberg, who in the 1970s was absolutely reviled by the government, reviled by these columnists as a traitor, a secret communist. They said he was secretly meeting with the Russians in the embassy in D.C. and selling information and so on and so forth. Of course, none of this was true. Nowadays, he's receiving awards around the world. He's regularly lauded by American politicians. And even these same kind of columnists that are arguing against public awareness today by saying, oh, well, let's apply this standard from the past 30 years ago and say that it's different then because we know no harm came as a result. But we're already reaching that point today. In 2016, no one's died as a result. The directors of the CIA, the DIA, the FBI have all been begged in front of Congress, give us a name, tell us who died as a result, you know. Show us where the harm was, is this. And they've never been able to show any convincing evidence at all. They've given nebulous claims, but they've never given a single specific example. And this is likely to continue. And this is why we see public opinion shifting inevitably over time, where fewer people are concerned that this actually helped terrorists, that this actually changed things. And more people recognize that whether or not these policies should be continued, the public at least deserves to know about them.
So, Laura, I'm going to give you the final word, and you can say whatever you want, but maybe you want to mention the fact that there's an exhibit at the Whitney related to your work and these issues. And I wonder where you think an art museum comes into it, and anything else you want to say.
Well, I mean, following Ed, I mean, I as we sit here, I mean, I don't think we could have imagined that we'd be having a conversation about encryption on the front pages of all the newspapers and leading stories and our privacy. I mean, these are things that were unimaginable when we began this reporting. So I'm just incredibly grateful to have been, took the risk that he took, and how it's benefited, citizens around the world. So I just think that we all owe him enormous gratitude.
Please thank Laura Poitras and Edward Snowden. Thank you very much, Laura. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.